half ago, now he sat across the bolted-down table from a man who had murdered, according to Linda Morgan's rough estimate, 100 people. So, why did you ask for me? Scanlan looked like an aging playboy who might have squired a Gabor sister in the 50s. He was small, wizened even. His graying hair was slicked back, his teeth cigarette yellow, his skin leathery from midday sun and too many long nights and too many dark clubs. No one in the room knew his real name. When captured, his passport read Monty Scanlan, an Argentinian national, age 51. The age seemed about right, but that would be about it. His fingerprints had not popped up in the NCIC computer banks. Facial recognition software had come up with a big goose egg.
We need to speak alone.
This is not my case, Scott said again. There's a U.S. attorney assigned to you.
This has nothing to do with her.
And it does with me? Scanlan leaned forward.
What I'm about to tell you,
he said,
will change your entire life.
Part of Scott wanted to wiggle his fingers in Scanlan's face and say, ooh. He was used to the captured criminal mindset, their serpentine maneuverings, their quest for an edge, their search for a way out, their overblown sense of importance. Linda Morgan, perhaps sensing his thoughts, shot a warning glare across his bow. Monty Scanlan, she'd told him, had worked for various connected families for the better part of 30 years. Rico hungered for his cooperation in a starving man near a buffet way. Since his capture, Scanlan had refused to talk. Until this morning. So, here Scott was.
Your boss,
Scanlan said, gesturing with his chin at Linda Morgan.
She hopes for my cooperation.
You're going to get the needle,
Morgan responded, still trying to give off the scent of nonchalance.
Nothing you say or do will change that.
Scanlan smiled.
Please, you fear losing what I have to say much greater than I fear death.
Right. Another tough guy who doesn't fear death.
She peeled herself off the wall.
Know what, Monty? The tough guys are always the ones who soil their pants when we strap them to the gurney.
Again, Scott fought off the desire to wiggle his fingers, this time at his boss. Scanlan kept smiling. His eyes never left Scott's. Scott didn't like what he saw. Scanlan's eyes were, as one would expect, black and shiny and cruel. But, and Scott might have been imagining things, maybe he saw something else there, something beyond the standard vacancy. There seemed to be a pleading in the eyes. Scott couldn't turn away from them. There was regret there, maybe. Remorse, even. Scott looked up at Linda and nodded. She frowned, but Scanlan had called her bluff. She touched one of the beefy guards on the shoulder and gestured for them to leave. Rising from his seat, Scanlan's lawyer spoke for the first time.
Anything he says is off the record.
Stay with them,
Scanlan ordered.
I want you to make sure that they don't listen in.
The lawyer picked up his briefcase and followed Linda Morgan to the door. Soon, Scott and Scanlan were alone. In the movies, killers are omnipotent. In real life, they are not. They don't escape from handcuffs in the middle of a high-security federal penitentiary. The Beef Brothers, Scott knew, would be behind the one-way glass. The intercom, per Scanlan's instructions, would be off. But they'd all be watching. Scott shrugged a well at him.
I am not your typical assassin for hire.
Uh-huh.
I have rules.
Scott waited.
For example, I only kill men.
Wow, Scott said. You're a prince. Scanlan ignored the sarcasm.
That is my first rule. I kill only men, no women.
Right. Tell me, does rule two have anything to do with not putting out until the third date?
You think I'm a monster.
Scott shrugged as if the answer was obvious.
You don't respect my rules?
What rules? You kill people. You make up these so-called rules because you need the illusion of being human.